Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest today, associate chair of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Really happy to have Scott back. And certainly he stands ready and able to answer your wildlife questions. So if you have one, please feel free to join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back.
It's good to be here, Larry, as always.
Deer season ended with the end of daylight on Sunday. What's the aftermath on that?
Well, it's proving to have been a very interesting deer season, as you know, as a hunter. Yep. The numbers are not all tabulated yet in terms of the overall harvest between adding up the archery harvest and the early antlerless season and the late antlerless seasons and the 9-day and so forth. But I think the traditional 9-day season centered on Thanksgiving week stirred up the most interest. And certainly a lot of deer were harvested. But as we had a chance to talk about briefly before, the harvest was down somewhat, depending on where you were in the state. For example, in the Northeast, it was down quite a bit during the 9-day. Elsewhere in the southern part of the state and South Central, it was down a lesser amount and fairly close to previous years. So that, of course, always sets off a flurry of speculation as, hey, what the heck happened? Where were all the deer? And lots of people did report seeing fewer deer than they expected to see and less sign than they expected to see, less deer activity, and that translated into a lower harvest. But what that all means remains to be seen, and one data point doesn't make for much of a trend line.
Right.
So after a number of years of record harvests, we're at a point now where things seem to be scaling down. It's not necessarily a bad thing, and it's not necessarily fully interpreted yet, but that will come over the next few weeks.
That was actually kind of a planned thing, isn't it? Really?
Well, it was a planned thing. I mean, there's been a lot of talk for quite a few years now that the herd was overpopulated in many units, and as a result, we saw all sorts of management strategies to work hard to get the herd down, like earn a buck in the T-zones and all sorts of things like that. And it appears that some of those management activities, coupled with likely more impact from last year's winter than we might have anticipated, and perhaps other factors as well, have pushed the deer herd down. Now, down to what level, we don't know yet. At least in the southern part of the state, in the chronic wasting disease areas, they're in the process of flying some helicopter surveys, which will actually give us hard information about how many deer there are in a given section of land, and that will...
That will help.
So we'll see.
You mentioned weather. And, you know, once again, like last year, we have deep snow and an ice glaze in southern Wisconsin. What does that mean for wildlife?
Well, it's not a good thing. We had record snowfall. And I think December was the snowiest month here around Madison that we've ever had. Not just December, but a record snowfall. And then we got that miserable ice glaze last weekend, and that's bad news for a lot of wildlife. Now, we learned last year, I think there were a couple things that happened last year, and as we talk later in the program about looking back at 08, the impacts of last year's record seasonal snowfall in the southern part of the state, and some pretty tough going in the northeastern part of the state, and then the spring floods.
Yeah.
Both of those things probably had more impact than we anticipated or thought at the time. And at least in the case of the deer herd, last year's winter weather may have affected fawn survival, the number of healthy fawns that were born, and it may have affected survival of some adult deer. I'm inclined to think that there was some concern over turkeys, and yet this previous spring, one of the other things we can talk about for 2008 was yet another record turkey harvest, suggesting that there were plenty of turkeys out there. But we did see some other impacts with pheasants, for example.
Yeah.
Boy, the wild pheasant population just really took it hard after the combined impacts of those deep snows, the freezing that we had at several intervals last winter that made it impossible for a bird to get through that crust.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing the same thing again. So it's going to be kind of a double hit on some populations like pheasants, not going to be overly good for cottontail rabbits. The mourning dove population. I keep mentioning animals that are typically considered game species. One of the reasons I do that is simply because there are a lot of people keeping an eye on those populations for obvious reasons.
Sure.
And as a result, we know a little more about them. So the dove population that really took a dive this past fall isn't going to be helped again. So we'll see what happens come spring. We could get a big January thaw, and things will be great.
Well, John Martin, one of my weather guys, says it's not going to be as bad in January and February as it was last year. He is standing by it, and he's saying absolutely not as bad.
Absolutely is a pretty strong statement. Yep. We'll see.
We'll see. Shane in Port Wing, let's go to you now. Hi, Shane. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a problem with what I think is a weasel that has been getting into my house. I saw it only once, and it was in November. And it was had a long, narrow body, about 12 inches long, and it was black. And the tail was kind of bushy, but not as long as the body. I'm sure it wasn't a squirrel. It is getting under the building somewhere, and we found a tunnel that was about 4 inches in diameter and blocked that tunnel off, but it's still getting in somehow, and it's chewing on wood and chewing on rigid insulation. And we've set a live trap, and if it is a weasel, we put a meat bait in there, and I don't know what this weasel is doing, but it's digging up all the insulation, and several times we found the live trap full of insulation, but no weasel. So I'm just wondering if you can suggest how we can
get rid of it. Okay.
Well, first of all, Shane, I kind of doubt that it's a weasel.
Yeah.
Although the description sounds reasonable, weasels generally are not a household pest. If they're in there at all or enter under a house or in a wall void, it's usually because there's something in there they're interested in, like a rodent population that would provide them with a food source. And they're also not built for nor interested in doing the kind of damage you suggested, chewing on wood or insulation.
Mm-hmm.
Not something they would typically do. So I think you've either – I'm not saying you didn't see a weasel and that a weasel may not be coming and going, but I think there's something else going on in there too, which is probably more likely related to rodents.
Okay.
And as a result, I would change my baiting strategy, and rather than use a live trap – you can still use the live trap, but bait it with take a couple of crackers, put some peanut butter on them, and position those back behind the bait pan up against the back of the trap,
mm-hmm.
or throw a few sunflower seeds in and see what that does for you. But I would also stick a couple of rat-size snap traps, you know, the plain old, like a giant mm-hmm. mouse trap.
Yes, I know what they are.
Yep. Bait a couple of those, again with peanut butter, and to be on the safe side, take a little piece of cloth, just a little piece, maybe as big as your thumbnail, and tie or wire that tightly on the trigger, and then smear the peanut butter into that, and then set those under there or
okay.
near the opening, and see what you catch.
Okay, thanks.
And see what happens with that.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kevin in Tomahawk, it's on to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
I've got a question for you on deer hunting. As far as if they ban baiting, will that make the deer less nocturnal? Because what happened is I've been bow hunting, and as soon as season closed, a half hour after nighttime, I have 5 to 7 bucks coming that I can't find during the day at all. Is there a way to get them to be a little bit more in the daytime?
Well,
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
There are lots of theories, Kevin, about what's going on with nocturnal deer behavior. In some cases, hunters and biologists attribute that to the pressure being put on the herd. You know, we've had extended seasons in lots of areas, a lot more hunting opportunity than the deer might have been used to in years past. And there's also some speculation that baiting has changed movement and behavior patterns as well, as the deer don't have to move as much as they normally would and therefore are perhaps inaccessible to some hunters. Whether and how fast, if baiting were banned, A, there's no guarantee that there would be complete compliance on that, and some states would, their experience would suggest that that's a difficult situation to enforce. But certainly, at least in my opinion, reduced feeding and baiting would restore something like what we're used to as more normal deer movement patterns, which hunters can then pattern, study, and exploit during the hunting season.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. We, as I mentioned earlier, we had an email. Cynthia actually emailed us earlier this month asking, how are the guidelines, laws, and limits established for hunting Canada geese in Wisconsin? She also asked, wouldn't it be more sensible, fair, and humane to not kill the largest geese in the flock. She says, I've observed how important each individual's bird's role is in the family constellations. The attentive parent and guardian to nursemaid, the nursemaid that sternly brings up the rear of the line of trailing gosling, the sentries that sit 10 feet out from the shoreline to watch for danger as everybody else feeds, to the late summer appearances of the drill sergeants that loudly bark and honk on all to gather and begin trial migrating flight formations. All roles seem important to the family system.
Wow. A very thoughtful question, Larry, and one that will require a fairly convoluted answer. This is a subject near and dear to my heart because, I think, recall, I worked on Canada geese for both my graduate degrees and caught and handled and banded about 10,000 of them in the Horicon area and in northern Canada. So I spent a lot of time with geese, and I have a great deal of respect for them. But let me try and get to the nub of a couple of her questions. The issue of how the laws and limits are set in terms of hunting Canada geese are complicated by the fact that they're an international migratory resource. So they're covered under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And a number of, since they cover a number of different states in the United States and a number of different provinces in Canada and two national countries, yeah, there are a lot of entities involved in setting the regulations. The regulations for a given year are set based on the status of individual Canada goose populations, and a harvest quota is obtained, and that's divvied up by a variety of procedures that allocate the harvest among states within the United States and provinces in Canada. And then it's up to the individual state to decide how they'll allocate their harvest quota within the state. In other words, is it a lottery for who gets what permits? How many permits do they get? How many geese can you shoot in a given day? And so on. And in some cases in Wisconsin, where we have quite a few waterfowl hunters, you know, in years past, it was kind of a one person, one goose. And mm-hmm. some years it's two geese a day and multiple geese. And early in the season, with the birds that live here all year, in September, you can actually shoot five. And then when the migratory birds come through, it's a lesser amount. So it's a fairly complicated situation. But it's a very carefully regulated management scheme to ensure that these individual populations of Canada geese persist and remain at the levels that the managers are hoping for. The greatest complication in recent years, or perhaps the last couple decades, is the burgeoning populations of Canada geese that live right here in Wisconsin. Not the birds that migrate from Hudson's Bay across Wisconsin, right, winter in Illinois and Kentucky, but the birds that live right in Madison on the ponds at the Coliseum mm-hmm. or in Milwaukee along sure. the harbor. And those birds are actually a different. This is further complicates the matter in that all Canada geese are not created equal. They're divided up into a number of subspecies, from the largest one, the so-called giant Canada geese that nest right here in Wisconsin, to little tiny ones up in the subarctic. They all look basically the same in terms of plumage patterns, but they might range from the size of a duck to 15 or 20 pounds
yeah.
for some of the birds around here. And all those things are taken into account. So the issue of Cynthia's question about does it make any sense to shoot the largest and perhaps most important geese in the flock, first of all, that suggests that most hunters can actually be selective
yeah.
and look at a flock and say, well, I'll take that one. But it doesn't work that way.
No.
You get a shot at what you get a shot at, and most hunters are not able to be selective. Mm-hmm. And the goose that comes down may just as well be a fairly young gosling mm-hmm. as the 15 or 20-year-old gander, and they do attain that age that's been with the flock for years. So I don't think that that's a huge issue in terms of goose management, is whether or not the older or more experienced birds are removed by hunting in some disproportionate way. So anyway, it's an interesting yeah. question. There's lots of literature on the subject if Cynthia wants to dig into it, but it is a system that's evolved over a number of years. The geese are flourishing. Goose hunting opportunity is as good as it's ever been. Seems to be working.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking your calls and questions on wildlife with Scott Craven at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. One more email before we go back to the phones. Chris in La Crosse wonders why whitetail bucks seem to seek out pine trees to rub their antlers on. We have acres of hardwood forest with a few scattered pine, and yet the bucks always seem to rub on the pine trees.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure why there'd be any preference unless there's something with the, you know, it's possible that as they start rubbing, the main objective is to get that velvet off their antlers. And if the sticky sap or whatnot that's typical of the evergreens, you know, helps kind of grab onto those little shards of velvet and whatnot and do a better job, maybe there's some practical reason like that. But yeah, in my own case, although they do seem to beat the heck out of the few red pines that I have scattered amongst my tree plantings, they seem particularly prone to the poplar and aspen stems.
Yeah.
That are nice and straight and kind of cued to the right size for the size bucks in the area. And they do hit the deciduous trees pretty hard. But I can't give Chris a better answer than that.
Colette in River Falls, your turn now. Hi, Colette.
Hi, I'm just looking to identify a bird that I think what it is a fox sparrow, but they say it shouldn't be in that area according to Mike Peterson book. It's a sort of a rusty brown with a white flecked chest, and sort of has a little gray on its head, and it's bigger than all the sparrows and finches that I have.
Well, it sure with a nice like, rusty brown, it sure sounds like a fox sparrow.
It's out, but it shouldn't be here. So
don't believe everything you you read in terms of what should or shouldn't be. Over the years, we've. The most interesting things that we've heard about or talked about, I think, on the program have always been the anomalies of a bird that's in seemingly the wrong place or the wrong time, and that's what makes things interesting. So,
well, I'm close to a state park, so I get lots of birds.
Right. Yeah, and furthermore, you could actually go online. Scott, what's the I'm trying to remember.
eBird.org, and then there's a Wisconsin version, and you could see what...
How many fox sparrows have been seen in Wisconsin?
Yes, and or what was just turned up on the recent Christmas bird counts in your area. So you could either in, let's see, you called from River Falls. I'm just trying to think of where the nearest Audubon Society, but you could check with wherever there's a local Audubon Society chapter in terms of what they're tracking. Go to eBird.org, or even if you're familiar with or have used the Wisconsin Nature Mapper, wisnatmap.org. That's another way that citizens report what they're seeing and finding and so forth.
Wisnatmap.org.
Yep.
So those are some places to go and take a look. But, you know, we could see a fox sparrow here in Wisconsin.
You know, Larry, you could see just about anything.
At any
given time, you could see just about anything.
Bob in Iola, we're on to you. Hi, Bob.
Oh, you know, on the deer rubbing their horns against the trees, up at my place, they seem to prefer balsam. And I wound up killing a buck a number of years ago. He had balsam still on his antlers.
Huh.
It wasn't to rub the velvet off. I think they like the way it smells, you know, and that's just a guess.
Well, I do.
Whenever
I go buy a balsam in the woods, I pluck a few needles and crumble them up in my fingers just to smell like the Christmas season when I'm hunting. So
share that.
Maybe the bucks feel the same way.
Yeah, we share that. Okay.
Okay.
Question I got for you here. On the relative feed value of some of the food that's available to the deer at this time of the year, we had deer actually starve to death. I'm in central Wisconsin last year.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen that for 10 years before when the snow got really deep.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, I watched a small herd of four deer eating oak leaves off a tree that had broke off in August with green leaves tipped over, and the leaves are still on because they don't shed them. You know, the tree is dead. And I would have thought that food value there was almost zip. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree with that seems like a pretty low return food situation. But when deer are pressed, they'll eat just about anything. And, you know, back to the days when starvation and issues like that around deer yards were more commonly thought of, there were food items that were described as stuffing foods, foods that they would eat and could literally die or starve with a full belly of them. But there hasn't been a lot of, primarily because of the kinds of winters we've had over the last decade or two, there hasn't even been much consideration given to deer starvation, excuse me, or condition. And that's primarily because in an agriculturally dominated landscape, which we see in, you know, the biggest chunk of Wisconsin, and the amount of feeding that goes on in the north, it just hasn't been much of an issue for them.
Yeah.
Now with deep snow or ice glaze, if they're really pressed, they'll eat or browse nearly anything they can get a hold of.
Yeah. And thanks for calling, Bob. Appreciate your call, too. Ruth in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Well, hi, Scott and Larry. I'm so glad that you're doing this show. The first caller had a weasel-sized black animal with a bushy tail living under her house. And since not all skunks have stripes, if she had called and said, I think I have a skunk living under my house, would your advice be the same for her to set traps under the house?
No, not at all, but I think a skunk is such a chunky animal, and if she's been rummaging around putting traps in the hole, that a skunk would have left enough residual odor that she'd have known if she had a skunk.
All right.
Certainly not, although if you do have a skunk around, they're very easy to catch in a live trap baited with cat food or whatnot. But that's the problem.
Yeah.
And the then what then becomes the fact that they're a fairly docile animal, and if you cover the trap use a trap that's covered in the first place, you can usually move them around without being sprayed.
Brother-in-law is an animal control officer, and he brings a tarp. And he says that, first of all, he carries the tarp and holds it in front of himself like a curtain as he approaches the trap so that the animal can't see it's really being approached by a being. And then he covers the trap with it without the animal seeing him, and then he would be able to transport it that way. But that's hard to do in a crawl space.
Yeah. It is, and it reminds me of a good friend of mine who started out an animal control business around here. We've told this, not for years, Larry, but it's a great one, and that's exactly what he would do. He would walk up to the trap with an old blanket or tarp and then slowly cover the trap, and then he could move the skunk, and he did that many times without any problem until, as he was approaching the trap, he stumbled on the corner of the blanket and fell on the trap with the blanket, and you know what the skunk did very quickly. So you have to be at least a little bit graceful if you're using that technique.
Thanks for calling, Ruth. Appreciate your call. Email here from Mary in Shell Lake does some snow shoeing, and this morning she saw something that baffled her. I purposely did some measuring, studying to remember what I saw. These were narrow, long, narrow body prints in the snow. I think about 8 inches wide with some variation in width. The bizarre thing is that they were 12 to 15 feet apart. Each print had a long, snake-like tail print with no bushiness to the tail. Each entire print was about 3 to 4 feet long.
That's an otter moving across the countryside.
Yeah, that's an otter. I would have thought the same myself. So there you have it, Mary, an otter. Mark in New Glarus, on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
I've got a great idea for a master's thesis, although I'm sure someone's done this before, but there must be a correlation between the number of deer killed by cars and the total deer population. I would almost think that would be more accurate than just helicopter surveys and the like.
It's a reasonable index, Mark, but actually there have been some folks who have worked on it in years gone by, particularly in New York State, but elsewhere. And the conclusion of most of the folks, certainly more deer are killed when there are more deer, and intuitively, if there are a whole slew of deer, your odds would seemingly go up in terms of hitting one, but the relationship is not perfectly linear or one-to-one. So while deer kills by motor vehicles are a useful index to deer populations, as are things like damage complaints and sightings and assorted other things, it's still not as good as a one-to-one count if you can do that with a helicopter or something else. But even that has some limitations, and it's certainly expensive, and nothing that could be replicated over a big chunk of Wisconsin.
Okay, well, and I bring it up because apparently the number of deer killed in, for instance, Marathon and Lincoln counties was down.
It was
50% or something.
Yeah, as I look at the figures here, let's see, northeastern or northern region rather, overall we're down close to 30%, and in the northeast. 2007 versus 8, It was still around 30%, and I think there were some areas where you're right. It was in individual counties may have been down closer to 50%.
But
and one would assume that there will therefore be less motor vehicle collisions.
But there was also fewer miles driven this last.
Another confounding problem.
Another confounding problem because I know mileage. Death rates on highways have dropped precipitously too, and part of that's related to the number of miles traveled.
Well, Mark, it's a good idea, and certainly the biologists do consider deer vehicle collisions not only as an issue in deer management, but as an index to what's going on. But I think people are still waiting for the final harvest figures and whatever we can glean from surveys like the helicopter counts to see what's going on.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
I think that there's general consensus that there were probably fewer deer in some areas going into the season than we may have thought there were.
Thanks, Mark. Luke in Chippewa Falls, on to you now. Hi, Luke.
Hi there. My wife started doing this bird watch, theater watch thing. I think it's through Cornell University. Anyway, she reports her findings on the internet on her website. But we have a new bird at our feeders, and we've identified it as a northern shrike, and we're sure it's what it is. It looks sort of shaped like a chickadee, but bigger, like mole robin size with a hooked beak. Anyways, this bird, what we read about it, is kind of unique for a songbird in that it's a predator. It eats
It's called the butcher bird.
Yeah, yeah, and interestingly enough, we found out it eats mice, and it kind of stockpiles its stuff, and then impales it on thorns, and impales its meals on barbed wire fences for further eating. And he sits right at our feeders all the time now. And I know he eats mice. And I know we have mice below our feeders, obviously eating all little sunflower seeds and whatnot. But we haven't seen really any other birds since he's shown up. Do they eat like goldfinches and whatnot that are small enough to eat?
Well, good question. And I'm going to defer to some of our birding experts that I know are listening in terms of food habits of shrikes to see if songbirds turn up occasionally. I would think it's possible, but I think that they do tend to concentrate on other things other than birds because they're not as well equipped to capture small birds as something like a Cooper's hawk or a sharpshin.
They don't have the claws.
So given their equipment limitations and their small size relative to most avian predators of birds, I think they're limited in that regard. But the presence of the shrike may have at least put a little damper on your feeder activity for the time being. If that is the case, however, and things begin to thin out, either the shrike has depleted what it's interested in the area, or the birds have simply scattered, the shrike will eventually move on and you'll be back in business. But it certainly is an interesting sighting, and it does lead us into the upcoming collaborative effort with Cornell here in mid-February, if you want to talk about that later.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's coming up February, 13th or something like that?
13th to the 16th. And the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology is one of the big ornithological installations and kinds of centers for bird-related work in the country. And this Project Feeder Watch that Luke was talking about is something that goes on throughout the year. As a citizen science type project, but there's also a kind of a time-specific one that comes up, as we just said, February 13th to 16th. That's called a Great Backyard Bird Count. And this is just a heads up. There'll be more information coming out over the next few weeks, and if we don't talk about it in early February, if Bill Volkert's on, he probably will. But last year, participants nationwide in this particular weekend event submitted 85,000 bird checklists, and 635 species of birds were documented across North America. So the point is there are a lot of people interested in participating in these things, as Luke's wife is with Project Feeder Watch. And if you're curious as to what's going on and would like to participate, find out a little bit about the Great Backyard Bird Count coming up, participate, and then you've got access to all this great information of what other people are seeing.
And I guess if you just put in your search engine, Great Backyard Bird Count, I'll try that and see.
And if that doesn't work, the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology will get you there. And I suspect there's also information on eBird that we talked about earlier. If our callers, if someone familiar with or can check the food habits of shrikes and see how frequently or if at all small songbirds turn up, then that will be helpful as well.
Thanks again for that call, Mike. Appreciate it. And Jeff in Chilton sent us an email. This past fall, the chipmunks discovered my bird feeding station and emptied my feeders daily. I stopped feeding the birds for a period of about 2 months until I was sure the chipmunks were hibernating. My question is, what causes chipmunks to begin hibernating? Does day length trigger hibernation, or possibly temperature weather trigger it, or a certain time of the year?
Well, it's the certain time of year, of course, is a matter of temperature and day length, and that's what eventually sends them down. The most immediate cause, of course, would be inclement weather, but as day length shortens and temperature drops, it's time for the chipmunks to go down. And most of his seed that they've removed is probably stored in great big piles underground now in the chipmunks' burrow system. But I think that if Jeff wants to prevent that next year, there are certainly ways to put a mammal guard or a sliding pole or something on his feeders so that the chipmunks can't get at the food.
Don in Sparta, on to you now. Hi, Don.
Good afternoon, guys.
Hi.
I do quite a bit of coyote hunting out in this part of the area, and I've come across a few what I thought were coyotes, but they had a reddish tint to their fur, and when I take them to the guy that buys my furs, he refers to them as a coy dog, and I guess I'm not really sure what a coy dog is. I've never heard that term used before.
Well, it's a more common term applied to the east of us, Don, and it's simply an expression of a coyote dog hybrid or cross.
Oh.
And a more common issue in the northeastern part of the country. But members of the dog family are kind of a bizarre relationship. In some cases, there are hybrids, but in other cases, you know, they just don't tolerate each other. So all other things being equal, coyotes don't like fox, wolves don't like coyotes, and so forth. But with the variation in domestic dogs, there are cases where coyotes do hybridize with them. The resulting hybrid animal is called a coy dog. Whether the reddish tint you're seeing in some of your coyotes is actually a coy dog hybrid or not, I'm a little suspicious of that. My experience is that coyotes have enough variation between animals that you get some with a darker tint, with a reddish tint, a rusty tint, a cream-colored tint, you know, beyond the normal kind of black, dark-tipped hairs that you would see.
Right. And
so,
you know, out of about 20, it's only been maybe two that I've gotten that have had the real bright, like the bright redness on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a significant amount of coyotes.
Yeah.
My suspicion is that that's individual variation in the coyote population more likely than it is hybridization with dogs or anything else.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling, Don. Appreciate it. And Bruce in Brookfield, we're on to you. Hi, Bruce. Bruce, are you there?
Yes. I have a quick question.
Sure.
With regard to owls, there are a couple, I think, horned owls. They the kind that go hoot, hoot, as opposed to the screech owl.
Yep.
And I'm curious, two questions. Do they have an effect on other birds? They scare away other birds? And number two, they seem to always want to hoot in the evening. And I'm curious, does that scare away the prey that they're trying to hunt?
No, they're not. They're not interested in hooting for purposes of
not
scaring or attracting prey or whatever else. But this time of year, they'll be doing a lot of hooting because we're right on the. Although it's only January, we're right on the cusp of the horned owl nesting season. They're about our earliest nesting bird, so that by February, nesting activity will be underway. I actually had a couple people talking about this in the corridor in the department this morning, that the horned owls are out and about, sitting on rooftops and in neighborhoods and becoming very vocal in the evening. But that's what they do to communicate with each other, and it has little or nothing to do with their prey.
And thanks very much for calling. And we'll take some more calls here. Roger in Fitchburg is next, so let's go there. Roger, hi.
Hi. Although I'd spent quite a bit of time in the woods, I'd never seen a fox that was looking across the road, I mean a subdivision here near Madison, the other day, and think that I might have seen one. It was kind of a goldish brown, rather bold, I thought. I thought the foxes were secretive, but it was standing and just kind of looking across the road for 10 seconds or so and then went into some trees. Do they behave and look like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything that was a golden brown or reddish brown certainly was probably a red fox, although if it looked kind of rusty brown on the extremities but more gray on the back, it could have been a gray fox. Far more likely that it was a red fox, and it's not at all uncommon to see one strolling across a field or someone's backyard. And if they've gotten habituated to folks around a subdivision or whatnot, they can become quite bold. And we've had, over the years on the program, we've had numerous callers who have had I remember one from Door County who said that every day, recall the person who said every day at 5 o'clock when they were getting ready to have cocktails on the patio, the fox that was in the neighboring woodlot would stroll up to the patio, sit on the edge of the patio and watch them until they flipped it a cracker and cheese or something, and then it would go about its business. So,
oh, that's wonderful. Was it just looking for mice, do you think, or could it be after, hopefully, some of the cats?
We don't want to go there right now, but it could have been looking for just about anything, or it could have been simply going from point A to point B, or been disturbed by something else and trying to get out of the way. No way to know.
But no way to know.
You were lucky to be able to get a look at it.
Thanks for calling. And Kathy in Cameron, we go to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just wanted to tell a little story about a shrike last winter, a songbird. I can't remember exactly. I think it was like a chickadee. Hit the window, and I went to see if it was okay. It hit really hard, and here I look down, and there's this other big bird by it and kind of nudging it, and all of a sudden he grabbed it in his beak and flew away with it. And
that was a shrike.
Yeah. They are beautiful, but that was kind of a little disheartening.
Well, it does certainly agitate people when they're, you know, used to watching certain birds around their feeder and a Cooper's hawk or something swoops in and snags a cardinal. But it's the way it is, and we enjoy seeing the hawks and shrikes as well as the songbirds. So this is our first evidence of a shrike, but it doesn't really suggest that the shrike preyed on the chickadee, but rather took advantage of the situation that the chickadee may have killed or injured itself. So,
however, Patty,
oh, here we go.
Patty from Green Bay has emailed us, and Patty says a shrike will definitely kill a small songbird at a feeder. We saw this happen right outside our window. The shrike grabbed a goldfinch, snapped its neck to kill it, and then he flew off with it after a few minutes. And she actually had an attached, which we can't show, obviously, but please see the attached photo taken by my husband, Joel.
Well, there you have it. Okay, the evidence is mounting. So back to our original caller, whom I think was Luke, if my notes...
Kathy. Oh, you mean the original caller.
Yes,
yeah,
in Chippewa Falls. So the evidence is mounting that the shrike may be frightening the birds away from your feeder, and you'll have to wait until it moves off.
Thanks again for calling, Kathy. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a wildlife question, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, and we will follow up with you. And Roy in Appleton's up next, so let's go to Roy. Hi, Roy.
How are you doing today? I love that story about the shrike. We've also trailed wolves through our backwoods. I've got a question, though. We have land on Little Maiden Lake in northern Oconto County, and our son was out snowshoeing this weekend and came across what he thought was a fisher track, and we started having a debate. Was it a fisher or was it a pine marten? And how far is the range of fishers? Would they get into northern Oconto County? That was really our question. And we've got some pretty good woods beyond us. We're bordered on three sides by the Nicolet Shawamigan National Forest.
Well, Roy, I think we can safely say that fishers are probably easily found in that area. And actually, although not too many years ago, they were kind of considered to be strictly a northern third of the state and then northern half of the state kind of animal. Over the last few years, they've turned up periodically, even in the southern part of the state. And we had a woodland owner who found one on his property, and I think got some pictures of it just a few weeks ago in Richland County, just a little bit west-northwest of Madison. I have a very nice picture of a fisher sitting in an aspen tree in Governor Dodge State Park west of Madison on the way over toward Dubuque. So they do get around. So even if you're not in the center of their range where they'd be expected with some regularity, you could see a fisher just about anywhere these days. And I certainly suspect if you saw tracks that he thought were fisher, that that's quite possible and far more possible than a martin.
All right.
Okay, yeah, now we can add that to our phenology calendar. We've been doing it for about 30 years up there. It's amazing what you can look after. If we can put that all on a computer, it would be an interesting story.
Yeah.
There you go.
There's probably a way to do that. I'll bet anything there's a phenology. There's some sort of program online that would allow you to do just that, Roy. I bet you could find it. Loretta in Medford, on to you. Hi, Loretta.
I have a video taken on March 29th, 2004, of a northern shrike down in our pasture that was singing beautifully, and the song comes through on the video. But then on April 4th of 2004, I found impaled on a buckthorn branch a small songbird. The remains were a little bit difficult to identify. The feathers are black and some red and some white, so definitely there was an impaled songbird that singing shrike had found.
Well, there you go. Okay, the evidence. Thank you, Loretta. The evidence is absolutely incontrovertible now. We've got dead songbirds and shrikes linked. Thank you.
We have them. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Email from Peggy in Mondovi. We have lots of wild turkeys around Mondovi, but lately I haven't seen any. Where do they go in the winter?
Well, it depends a little bit on the setting, but they tend to gather up. They don't really migrate per se, but they do tend to gather up in larger flocks and congregate wherever there's a suitable food source. If there's a lot of snow, it might be a south-facing slope. It might be an agricultural valley in another otherwise wooded area where somebody's spreading manure that they utilize. It might be a spring seep where there's watercress they're feeding on. But generally, they can gather up in large flocks numbering hundreds of birds, so that where they are, you see a lot of them, and where they aren't, you don't see any. Come spring, they'll break back up again and go back and inhabit the range they normally occupy.
And the new issue, Jim Packer tells me, the new issue of Wisconsin Outdoors has a picture of a shrike taking a songbird. That's just out today, the new issue of Wisconsin Outdoors. And let's see, we have, who is this now? Bonnie has lots of mice in her attic. Not sure where they came from. Any suggestions on who to contact? I have had Will Kill out to get them out and no luck. I just don't want to be taken advantage of trying to get these critters out of my house.
Well, the issue with mice wherever they are in a house, Larry, is related to what their access is. How are they getting into the house?
Right.
And that requires a meticulous search, and it's very difficult to do in the dead of winter when the sill plate of the house, for example, may be under the snow and you can't even tell where they're coming in. But they usually are entering low in the house, and they're working, if they're in the attic, they're working on their way up through the wall voids or between the studs and getting up into the attic. From a homeowner's perspective, you can either attempt to tackle the problem yourself using traps or rodenticide baits, and there are many bait stations and bait box kind of things available. You can try that, but rodents are difficult to deal with, and obviously the professional pest control companies flourish and thrive offering the service of dealing with these kinds of things. So it becomes homeowner option. Do you view it as a do-it-yourself project, or do you want to hire a professional?
There you have it. Let's go to Mike in Cushing next. Mike, hello to you.
Good morning. Scott, a couple years ago, several years ago, I was with one of the first coverts projects, and mm-hmm. I was wondering, I noticed the website isn't updated for 2009, and what is the due date for that? Because I have a friend that would be very interested in going.
And to explain what a coverts workshop is, Scott.
Well, it's funny you should call, Mike, because I'm holding the two 2009 brochures in my left hand as we speak. And Larry and I plan to talk about this a little later in the program to capture our Illinois listeners. But I'll just tell you right now that the Wisconsin workshop, Mike, is August 13th to the 16th at the Kemp Natural Resources Station up in Woodruff, where we've had it before. And then there'll be another one a couple weeks later at the end of August, the 27th to the 30th, in Dundee, Illinois. And we'll say a little bit more about that later. But the project itself is our, Our Extension Wildlife team, consisting of Jamie Knack and David Drake and myself, have been working for a long time, since 1993, I think, with the Rough Grouse Society and other supporters to offer what's called the Wisconsin Coverts Project. And it literally is a woodland wildlife management program for private landowners. And we invite, by application, up to 25 landowners in a group to attend a pretty intensive three-plus-day workshop, which consists of both classroom experiences, field tours, our interactive displays, discussions, and just about any other medium we can think of, to get across to the landowners what their options are for furthering or promoting wildlife interests on their own property. But then the key thing is, as you well know, as a former cooperator, enlisting these folks who participate to be ambassadors for good woodland wildlife stewardship, to reach out across the fence to their neighbor or across the street or within their community to attempt to get other people involved in managing their property, not just for woodland wildlife, but essentially trying to convey the notion that we'd like the private landowners to be as good a steward of the landscape as they can possibly be. And these workshops facilitate that. So more on that a little bit later.
Yeah, we'll talk after the after our news break. We'll talk some more about that. Thanks, Mike, for calling. Matt in Janesville, on to you. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I appreciate your show. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a couple quick questions. One, I'm curious if anyone was able to tell me, I don't know if it's the appropriate term or not, mountain lions in northern Wisconsin. I have a family member who has a motion camera that she puts in the woods, and they caught a picture of a mountain lion. And I wondered if anyone knew what the population is like in Wisconsin or if it's growing. And the other question I had was related to wild turkeys. My father was out in our land about a month ago and found a half-eaten carcass. Wondered if maybe that was a coyote or what you might think would be the culprit there.
Well, let's take the turkeys first. A dead turkey would be consumed or eaten on by just about anything that would go through the woods. So if the turkey, in fact, died due to accident, starvation, or whatever else, there are any number of things from mice and shrews to squirrels
eagles.
And fox and eagles and a whole host of things that would feed on it. In terms of actually killing it and feeding on it, coyotes are a good possibility. They do prey on turkeys, as would a fox if it could get a hold of it, and a few other predators. But there are certainly many things that would scavenge a dead one. So on the mountain lion front, or cougar front, as more people are prone to call them, don't question the fact that someone caught the photograph. If they have good documentation of that, they should pass it along to Adrian Weideman with the Wisconsin DNR in Park Falls, who tracks that kind of thing. There are cougar sightings regularly. Some pan out, some don't. There was always a great deal of skepticism until just about a year ago when the now famous Milton Cougar was first seen in January, and then it was tracked across southeastern Wisconsin over the course of 4 months until ultimately, I think, on the 14th of April, it was killed by police officers outside Chicago. So that one was actually documented. Yes, there was a cougar, and that one's now dead, but certainly there are others around, but there's no... there's really no information on population, population status, reproduction, or anything like that.
All okay, right? Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Angie in Lancaster, your turn. Hi, Angie.
What's that?
Your turn. Go ahead.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's my... Okay. I have birds.
Yeah?
Oh, wait, I have to shut my radio off.
Oh, you should always shut your radio off when you call
there.
In.
Okay.
All right.
I'm autistic.
Okay.
Just so you know. But I have, I have autism.
Yes.
But every time, and just within this last year, I got into birds. And every time I say the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, art in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
When I say that prayer, the good birds come out.
Well, that would be something that I
Well, that may be at a higher level than we can than we can respond, Larry. But you know, certainly, we've always promoted and are thrilled by just about everybody, anybody, anywhere, at any time, getting involved with birds, birding, or any other wildlife aspect of wildlife. So if Angie's kind of become turned on by birds.
That's good for her.
She has some personal way to interact with them or seemingly attract them. You know, great. Keep up the good work.
And, you know, it may be a function, Angie, of when you say the Lord's Prayer. If you say it the same time every day, you know, I know at my own bird feeders, for example, there are certain times of the day when in the morning, for example, there won't be a bird there. And then suddenly there are 25 of them. They all kind of come together almost, and they usually leave at about the same time in the afternoon, 4-ish, 4:30-ish, somewhere in there.
Yep. In my case, it's Mr. and Mrs. Cardinal that arrive just before it's too dark to see them.
Yeah.
Feed for a few minutes, and then they're gone.
And then they're gone. Thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the wonderful world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Lots of emails and lots of phone calls here, Scott. So we're going to go right to the phones first and to Elaine in Tomahawk with a question. Elaine, hello.
Hi. My question is, I have been seeing two animals while walking. One is obviously a red fox. The other one is the bigger gray mixed with a little bit of red on its, you know, down towards its belly. That second one is what I'm calling about. You just commented about that possibly being a coyote. We definitely hear coyotes in the area in the evenings, so we know that they are there. I'm wondering if this is a coyote. I walk a small 7-pound dog. I'm out there by myself. Is there any danger to us?
Well, the animal you describe as being basically gray with kind of reddish or rusty extremities could also be a gray fox. Not a particularly huge animal, but they're so furry, they look bigger with that big bushy tail. And a gray fox is certainly a very secretive animal, and there's certainly no issue there at all, even less so than with a red fox. But whether you're seeing them or not, there are coyotes just about everywhere. They're quite a common animal, even if they're not commonly seen. So the basic question about are you at any risk, over the many years I've been doing this, I started out by saying, well, no, this is just about the same risk of being hit by an asteroid coming out of deep space. But on the other hand, there's been increasing dialogue amongst wildlife professionals and in the journals and magazines. And Larry and I were actually just talking about an article in Sports Illustrated just a month or so ago about some people feeling that some of these larger carnivores, coyotes, wolves, and so forth, although it's still a very small risk as far as people or in some cases pets are concerned, that as these animals become more accustomed to people and perhaps people are, you know, with ill-advised feeding and other things that habituate the animals, that the risks may actually increase over time. It's still very, very, very low. And I think simply walking in a relatively rural area with your pet, the risk of a coyote attack is very, very remote. But nevertheless, it's still something you know keep in mind. And if that's the case, or if you're concerned, you can always carry a can of pepper spray. You can carry a walking stick or something like that on the very outside chance that you might need it to fend off an attack. But I just don't think it's you know, there are coyotes routinely on my property, and we're out constantly roaming around with the dogs and maybe incorrectly don't give it a second thought, but it is something to at least consider.
And thanks very much for calling. And we'll take an email here. Barbara in Spring Green says, this is back to Shrike. Shrikes love songbirds. I spend summers doing surveys on their breeding grounds in Alaska with the National Park Service. For the past 4 years, I've watched shrikes teaching their youngsters to hunt. It's poignant to watch three shrikes chasing in formation a hapless Says Phoebe. fleeing up the valley, but it can also be quite comical when the young birds mistakenly chase Arctic ground squirrels, which are five times their size. Luke's songbirds are smart to stay away. Stop feeding for a while, and the shrikes will eventually move on. Yep. That's her advice.
Okay.
All right. Richard and Broadhead, on to you now. Hi, Richard.
Hi, good morning, guys. In regard to the gentleman who callers back about the cougar photograph, the photograph I received on email from my son, who got it from his brother-in-law's brother, was taken about an hour north of La Crosse along the river.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a deer carcass, evidently a roadkill. And just to be curious, he set up a trail cam on the carcass, and he got this series of four pictures of a it looked to me like a female cougar and two cubs.
Yeah, that picture was actually taken by cougar researchers in South Dakota, and it's been on the internet for months. And there's actually now, because internet photographs are almost impossible to trace, and for some reason people seem to get a kick out of perpetuating bogus information, there's actually, the DNR has put up a cougar hoax website that you can, I don't have the website with me, but again, this is something that Adrian's responsible for out of the Park Falls office. And that's one of the photographs that's on there. But one of the cougars in the photograph actually has an ear tag. And the photograph was, traced to South Dakota. There's been another one with the guy holding a monstrous cougar kind of in a garage that's dead. And I've seen that attributed to a dozen different counties in Wisconsin, but that's also a Western photograph. So I don't mean to deviate from the there are some valid photographs, and in the case of someone who said, "Gee, I just got this picture, and what is it?" You know, we can work that out. But there are some notorious ones circulating, and the one of the three cougars with a couple little pine trees feeding on half a deer carcass has been one of the common ones circulating on the internet that's been attributed to I don't know how many people's brothers, cousins, uncles, and various things. So that's – in fact, you know, we've talked about this before, Larry, but it's become very difficult for us to utilize the internet as a fabulous source of information.
Yeah.
But so much of the stuff we're seeing now proves to be bogus that it's hard to believe anything.
Yeah, it is.
So anyway –
there you have it, Richard. Thank you for calling. Fran in Menominee, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I am elated to be on your show. We have a camp that's approximately 40 miles north of Menominee, and at our hunting camp this year, we're sitting around the campfire, and lo and behold, about 9:30, the wolves to the west of us, we have known that they've been there for years, but we have never heard them howl, and they started to howl, and what a...
That's pretty neat, huh?
Oh, what an intriguing sound. It's so much different than coyotes. But I'm just wondering, what is the significance of the howling? Is it the start of a hunt, a triumph, or what? And I'll take my answer off the air, and thanks very much for having me on.
Sure.
Well, the significance of the howling for the wolves is pretty, I guess I'd have to say, it's pretty similar to the discussion you were probably having around the campfire.
Yeah.
Their howling is how they communicate with each other. Staying in touch with pack members, communicating, hey, time to move on, there's prey over here, whatever the message might be. And as biologists actually use howling to get some idea of surveying, they're pretty careful about minimizing howling to packs because they don't want to disrupt the social structure or activity or framework of a pack. So it's their vocalizations that are part of their pack communication. They're a social animal, and they talk to each other just like we do.
Herb in Wales, on to you now. Let's see. Hold on here a second. Let's get Herb on. Herb, hello.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Identification of a possible badger in my backyard last winter. Let the dogs out late at night, three schnauzers, and it made a racket and went out there. And they were surrounding this thing. All of a sudden, they started jumping on their toenails and backed off. And this thing let out a growl. It sounded about 85 decibels, the biggest growl. It sounded like it came from a bear. Turned around, thing walked around back, dragged itself across the yard in the snow. And when it was... before they turned around and went away, I noticed that it was down on its haunches and kept, and then its nose was kind of curled up in the air, and it certainly looked like a badger. But do they hibernate?
Well, they certainly are out and about and could be seen in the winter. But, you know, a badger, I'm distracted by the image of a whole pack of schnauzers attacking a badger in the snow. That kind of set me off course here. But anyway, you know, badger sightings, no matter when they occur, because we're here in Wisconsin, and, you know, everybody's got this mental image of the black and white striped face of Bucky Badger, that and they're such a squat, low slung to the ground, long-haired, silvery gray animal that there's usually not a lot of question about their identity. So, Herb, anything's possible in that regard, but you didn't see the animals. Well, if you saw its nose up in the air, did you get some indication that the face was black?
It certainly had the stripes, and certainly it looked like a badger to me. And then I'm thinking, well, it was the middle of winter.
No,
the worst thing about the whole situation, I was in the middle of radiation treatment. I've been a bit dizzy, you know, like I was under hallucination or something.
They could still be out and about, and if you thought you saw the striping and the curled nose and those low-slung animals slinking along and the growling, I think you saw a badger.
Yep, I think so too. Thanks for calling. Tim emailed us and wonders, he's got rabbits decimating his arborvitaes, and I don't think he wants to do any fencing. He's heard that that spraying the arborvitae with something might work. He's also heard that's not always effective. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, rabbits, especially this time of year and with the kind of snow cover and ice cover we have where they're pressed for food, can be very damaging to landscape plants. Whether it's arborvitae or anything else, the best way to protect them is to put some at least temporary fencing out to get them through the winter and then worry about it later on. If there's some aversion to the fencing, there are some repellents that could be used. There are some hot sauce-based repellents. That's a chemical called capsaicin is the active ingredient in hot sauce. There are thiram, which is a fungicide, thiram-based repellents that can be sprayed on. And there are some blood-based repellents like a Swedish product called Plant Skid that can be actually purchased in a spray bottle and sprayed on that may help. But weathering and so forth is a problem for the repellents, as is cost, which is why I still come back to the fencing, even though it may be temporary. But yes, those are the two options that Tim really has to deal with. Although, again, because they're pressed for food, if they were my arborvitae, I'd have a couple of live traps out there wrapped in burlap and baited with some green beans or apple slices or carrot coins, and you could thin out that rabbit population in a hurry right now.
June in Manitowoc says, we've noticed a possum has taken up residence in our city yard, which is fully fenced. We're enjoying the sighting, but wonder if we should discourage it. We have an old dog who knows the possum is here. He doesn't bark, but wants to constantly go out and sniff the hiding places. Are there diseases that could be transferred, and is it abnormal for a possum not to be hibernating at this time?
Possums generally are out and about during the winter whenever the temperature moderates a bit. And the more mild it gets, the more active the possums become. If it stays bitter cold, you won't see them at all. I don't think a possum around the yard is anything to get too agitated about. And most yards probably have a possum, whether the people know it or not. So if they can keep the dog and the possum separated, I don't think there's a whole lot to worry about there.
Susan in Bristol, we're on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you for identifying turkey vultures for me last year. I appreciate that.
Okay.
I have coyotes. I live on several acres in Bristol, and I have a female Weimaraner who's like a 70-pound dog. And the coyotes have frequently come out and tried to play with her. I can see them doing play bows and walking around in a circle, and I definitely discourage it. They've been making themselves more scarce since I got a very large male dog. He's a lab bloodhound, and he's probably about 140 pounds, and I haven't seen the coyotes so much since then.
Can't blame him for that.
Yeah. Now, I've heard that coyotes will try to take a medium-sized female into the pack. But if there is a large male, that he may be more at risk because they might want to attack him because they think of him as competition.
I don't think the issue of joining the pack is much of a concern, no matter what the issue is. Coyote behavior when they're around people and pets can best be described as bizarre. I actually had a gentleman send me an interesting YouTube video a few weeks ago of his fairly large dog in the backyard and a coyote clearly coming out of the underbrush and literally, I don't know how you could describe it other than frolicking around the backyard with the dog.
Yeah.
Which was a little bizarre to see. Smaller dogs are certainly at risk as potential prey. There's, as we discussed earlier, with the notion of coy dog hybrids, possibly other activities going on. But, of course, larger dogs, larger breeds, are routinely used as guard dogs to protect sheep and other livestock from coyotes, trained to kill them. So there are a lot of possible interactions, but no matter what the real intent is, and the coyotes and the dogs are probably the only ones that know, and they're not talking, I would do whatever I could to discourage the interaction of those coyotes with either one of your dogs and try and do whatever you can to make sure that they're as wary as they can possibly be. Otherwise, as they become more habituated to dogs and people, they become bolder. And that's when all of a sudden they encounter a dog of the wrong size or wrong temperament or a child, and then there are big problems. So I think it would be a good thing for you, your dogs, and the neighbors in the neighborhood to do everything you can to put the fear of humans and their pets back into those coyotes.
And thanks for that call. Paul Holton from the DNR called in to say the Cougar Hoax web page is actually on the UW Stevens Point website.
Okay.
So we need to go to that, and you can find, just go to that UW Stevens Point website and put in, I assume, Cougar Hoaxes or something, and it'll pop up. So I wanted to get that in. And let's talk about that Coverts project, because the Covert project, the workshops are coming up, and we need to let people know. One in Illinois,
we do,
one in
Wisconsin. And I kind of view this and talked with Jamie about it this morning. This is a recruiting opportunity for us too. I mean, we're looking for 50 really highly motivated, top notch landowners who would like to attend these two workshops come August, this coming summer. And again, one is in Woodruff at the university's Kemp Station on Lake Tomahawk, a beautiful spot. The other one, for the first time, will be in northern Illinois, in Dundee, just off of I-90 at the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation, which is also a beautiful place.
Beautiful spot.
Nice place. And again, what we're looking for here and what we seek among the applicants are landowners, particularly with Wisconsin properties. The larger the better, but larger properties are not essential. But we're interested in folks who are, again, not only interested in improving their own abilities as land stewards, but helping us with the so-called multiplier effect. We can't go out and talk to everybody. There's only three of us. But these folks have friends and neighbors and so forth that they can talk to, share some of the information they receive, some of the materials they receive, and have more of an impact on the landscape ultimately than David, Jamie, and I can have alone, or
sure,
all the other agency people around the state who are doing these kinds of things. So in any event, if there are landowners out there, particularly landowners in Illinois or the greater Chicago area, who have properties in Wisconsin and are interested in this idea, they should request an application and brochure from Jamie. And the best way to get either application for either the Wisconsin workshop in early August or the Illinois workshop in late August is to email Jamie Nack at jlnack, N-A-C-K, at wisc.edu. Pretty straightforward email address, jlnack at wisc.edu. Ask for a Coverts application for either Wisconsin or Illinois. We'll happily send you one. We'll pick our 25 folks, and I should point out that this is a freebie, Larry.
Oh, it's free.
It's 4 days, but you're fed like a king. The accommodations are provided, all the materials, the field trips.
Wow!
All you really have to do is get there, and it's a good deal. We have a good time as instructors. We bring in lots of other folks who talk about specific issues, and the attendees, based on our evaluations over the years, this is a fun time.
fun time.
Learn a lot, too. So we're looking for a few, kind of like the Marine recruiting tool, we're looking for a few good people. So give us a call.
Give us the information. The call you would email at...
Email Jamie at JLNACK, JLNAC at WISC.edu.
Is there a phone number, too?
Jamie's phone number, I think if I'm off the top of my head, 265-8264. 265-8264, area code 608. Here on campus.
608-265-8264.
And ask for the application, and then we go over the applications probably late spring, early summer, and then notify the folks who are going to be invited.
All right. And let's go to Doug in Greenfield then. Doug, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I had a couple quick questions for you. One is on shed deer antlers. How come some states allow you to collect them and other states don't? I would just, I guess, like to know the reasoning beyond that, you know? So you're not hunting anything, you're not hurting anything. I don't understand that, you know?
I don't understand it either, Doug, because I didn't think there were any states where you couldn't pick up a shed antler.
Oh, absolutely. In Wisconsin, you can on public land. In Illinois, you cannot on public land. You can on private land, but not on public land. And it just, I mean, all these parks and nature preserves and forest preserves, it just really doesn't make any sense to me.
Okay. I think that the issue here may be the public-private issue. I mean, shed collecting is a big deal around the country. I mean, lots of people participate as another form of outdoor recreation. Now, it's true that in some natural areas or, say, a place like Yellowstone National Park, a huge area, but you can't just go in there and pick up shed elk or deer antlers. Those are considered part of the park. It's like going to Dinosaur National Monument. You can't pick up Tyrannosaurus bones.
Yeah.
But in general, certainly on private lands with permission of the landowner, presumably, so you're not trespassing. And I thought if you're in Wisconsin, for example, in the Shawamigan or in the national forest or the state forest, it's my impression you can certainly pick up deer antlers.
Oh yeah,
you can. But why not in other states?
I think it's going to depend on the category of public land that we're talking about here. But I see. Unless they're trying to protect a site like a national park or a natural area, where, as in the examples I mentioned, I simply wasn't aware that in a state park, for example, you couldn't pick up deer antlers.
What about sharpshooters in parks, Scott? Anything? Are we using sharpshooters in parks for deer?
Well, there was kind of a hiatus in the sharpshooter program over the last year or so, but the new 10-year management plan for chronic wasting disease that is currently out for review and I think will go to the Natural Resources Board in February does call for the reinstatement and limited use of sharpshooters in some settings around the state. But currently, I don't think anything's going on.
And with that, we're out of time. Scott, thank you so much. Again, that Covert's, those workshops, 4 days, free everything, lodging and so forth. You've got to apply for it, though. The number to call is area code 608-265-8264. And again, the email address?
JLNACK, N-A-C-K, at WISC.edu. And remember, you need to be a landowner here. We're looking for people who control chunks of private land, wooded land primarily.
Scott Craven, thank you so much. You'll be back the first Wednesday of February, I'll bet.
It'll be a short gap because this is a late first Wednesday. So
yeah, it is.
Be back in 3 weeks, I guess.
All right. Thanks, Scott. And just to let you know, tomorrow we'll talk home renovation and repair issues. Chad Spate and John Viner, a couple of our regular guests, will be back once again. And thank you all for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Net.